Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We're going to try to make some real progress tonight because last week we took a week off in order to respond to the Calvinism bashers. And so this week we're back in the book of Numbers. We're technically in Numbers 31, and so you can turn to the book of Genesis, turn to Genesis 15. 2 weeks ago, as we were looking at Israel routing the people of the Moabites and the Amorites, and again this week as I read and listen to what the critics of the Bible say, because I believe you have to know your enemy and know the arguments that they're making. And one of the things that one of the Bible critics I was reading said was that, you know, so much bloodshed and unjustifiable bloodshed in the Old Testament, and he mentioned the way that Israel, when they came back to the land of Canaan, how they came into a land that was already occupied. There were already people there. And the notion was the people who were already there inhabiting the land of Canaan hadn't really done anything wrong. They just weren't Israel. And then Israel comes sweeping in and mops up the floor with them. And as we're going to see tonight, takes all their cattle, takes their women. And then as we saw 2 weeks ago, Moses says, not the women, they were the problem to start with. So the women who hadn't known a man, they could keep. They kept the children. They kept the gold and the silver. Everything was precious. They kept all the animals. And that just seemed inherently unfair to the commentator I was reading. I should also point out that there are two words that are used interchangeably through the Old Testament. And we're really reaching that point in the Old Testament now where these words are going to come up more frequently and be used interchangeably. The people who were kind of the occupants of the lowlands of Canaan were called Canaanites. The people, as we read a few weeks ago, who were more up in the hills, the highlands, were known generically as the Amorites, even though there are a people who are identified as the Amorites, who are a descendant of Ham. They became dominant in the area, and so the whole area was kind of known as Amorites, or they were known as Canaanites, and these are kind of interchangeable words for the people who lived right there, because you may see occasionally Moabites or Hittites or subgroups of people who were there in that area. I want to talk tonight about the people that Israel just wiped out and then took all their stuff. And then God said, okay, now all the stuff you took, distribute it. It all belongs to Israel now. And boy, that sure plays with our sense of fairness, doesn't it? It's like, well, how can God just say, go in there, wipe out a people group, take all their stuff, take their women and children, use them for servants, take all their animals, take their gold, take their cities, live in their houses? How can God just do that to a people group? Well, you can't understand it. And this was the problem that this fellow was having. You can't understand it if you don't understand a basic theological principle that is also the very beginning of where Reformed theology starts on the state of man, on biblical anthropology. If you don't understand that God sees all humans as inherently evil, wicked, and dead, then it does seem unfair for God to do this. Now, Israel is not any better than the Amorites. We see it again and again that Israel keeps doing the wrong thing, keeps chasing after foreign gods. We just saw that, and God had to kill 24,000 because of them chasing after the Amorite gods. They are people who have the same tendencies. They are people just like the Amorites who are just as likely to go after the wrong gods and chase after the wrong things. But God is protecting Israel for the simple reason that he chose Israel. And he said, you're going to be my people, and so I'm going to protect you from yourself, but I'm not going to protect the Amorites. In fact, when God, back here in Genesis 15, which is why I had to turn there, In Genesis 15, this is where God is answering Abraham when Abraham asked, well, how will I know that all these things are going to be true? You've told me that I'm going to inherit this land, the land of Canaan. You've told me I'm going to have it, you know, as far as my eye can see and everywhere that my foot touches, and my descendants are going to be like the sands of the sea and the stars of the heavens. And this is all going to happen through a natural child that I and my too old to bear children wife are going to have. And Abraham says, how do I know this is going to be true? And so God tells him his future in advance and says, I'm going to take your descendants into a land where they're not known, and they're going to serve there for four generations. Generation in those days was 100 years. They're going to be there for 400 years, and then I'm going to bring them out. But that's only one side of the big equation. We have a tendency to emphasize Israel's part in this so that we can say God chose Israel, and because they were his chosen people, when he put them into the Egyptian bondage, it was his intention to bring them out again in 400 years because he chose them. Yeah, but what about the people who are occupying Canaan all this time? Well, chapter 15, starting at verse 15, has a very interesting phrase in it that we can now begin to understand by plugging in this concept into what we're reading out of the book of Numbers. Genesis 15:15, and as far as you, Abraham, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. Then, in the fourth generation, they, your descendants, shall return here to the land of Canaan, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. What an interesting thing for God to say. The King James says, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. In other words, God has every intention of judging the Canaanites, the Amorites, the people who were living in the very land that God promised to Abraham. He told Abraham, I'm going to give you all this land. And oh yeah, there are people in all this land. So here's what we're going to do. You need to become a great number of people. So I'm going to take you into Egypt. Remember, it was originally, what, 12 guys? 12 brothers that went down into Egypt with their families and children, and they came out a million people plus. And so God's plan was twofold. It was to take Israel into Egypt and grow them into a mighty nation, but equally his plan was to give the Amorites sufficient time to be good and guilty, to really build up their iniquity, to really build up their rebellion against God, so that when the Israelites came, now as God's chosen sword, as God's chosen battering ram, as God's chosen means of judgment, he's now bringing his people back to this land, and the reason that his people are able to conquer the people that are there is because God is using them to pour out his judgment on the Amorites, which he's been letting brew for 400 years. And now he's starting to pour out that judgment. Shall we apply this for a moment? Because it's not tough, is it? No, because I do hear people say, boy, man, it sure seems like our country is going in the wrong direction. You can't turn on the TV or flip on your internet connection without seeing stories that just make you shudder, make your hair curl if you have any, make your skin curl if that's all you've got left. You look at these stories and you just go, what are these people doing? What are these people thinking? There is a joke going around that is a truism that says if God doesn't judge America soon, he's going to have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah because America now is doing things that are far beyond what Sodom ever did. And God poured out judgment on them. And human beings, because we are inherently egocentric, I'll go with that word. Okay, I'll go with my first sentence, and then we'll go back to egocentric. Because human beings are inherently stupid and egocentric, They think that just because God hasn't judged yet, that's an indication that God is not going to judge. They think that just because it hasn't happened yet, it's not going to happen. How long did the Amorites get away with continuing their rebellion against God, their chasing of foreign gods, their lifting up of all their other gods? They got away with it for all the years that Abraham was living in their land. And then the descendants of Abraham are taken out of their land. And then for 400 years, those people, the people God supposedly chose, are slaves in Egypt. And so the Amorites are thinking, we really don't have anything to worry about. There's nothing here that can harm us. Well, now God is showing the reality of his judgments. Just because he waits doesn't mean he's not going to do it. Now, America's 200 and something years old. Right? 1976 was our 200th birthday, so what do we got going there? Another 24 and 10, 34, 234 years?
Yep.
So we got like about 170 left if we're just going to use the Amorite count. You know what I'm saying? I'm not creating a one-for-one biblical principle where people can say, Jim McLarty says America has 166 years and then God's going to judge them. No, my point is the Amorites, because they kept getting away with it, kept thinking that there was no judgment coming. And God, because he's patient, because God's really got eternity, he knows. But listen to how he put it. I'm going to take a 400-year period to grow you people up in Egypt, then bring you back to this very land because the Amorites' sinfulness isn't full yet. I'm going to let it grow to the full, and then I'm going to use you to punish them. Now, he's also going to end up punishing Israel, as we just saw. He punishes Israel whenever they wander off the course. But he uses Israel, despite the fact that they're his chosen people, they're still sinful people, and he still uses them to judge the sinful people over here. What's the difference between the two groups? God chose one group, and he uses that group to punish the other group. You see, there is this phenomenal sovereignty that is woven all the way through the Bible. I don't care where you look, Old Testament, New Testament, wherever you look, you see a sovereign God doing what he sovereignly purposes with whoever he wants, whenever he wants. And just because he hasn't judged America yet doesn't mean he's not going to. Now, what we're going to see in Numbers, now we're over here in the book of Numbers, we're in Numbers 32. Numbers 31, we'll start there. We're going to start in verse 25. And we're just going to run quickly through the division of all the stuff they brought back. But at the end of it, as they take account, they come to the realization that every single soldier from Israel, every single soldier that went to the fight came home. They didn't lose a one. Proof again that God was in the fight. Now, they wiped out a large people group and their fortified cities and their homes and wiped them out. You would have to think, if this were just a natural fight, that at least somebody from Israel is going to get hurt. Somebody's going to get killed. The people who are fighting back are going to take out at least somebody. But because God was behind this, he used Israel and he preserved Israel to judge the Amorites. And God works this way all the time. This is just how God works. I've several times made reference to Isaiah 10. When you get a chance, go read it for yourself. You know what? Let's go read it now. Let's just do that because we're here and I have nowhere to be and I have no life. So keep your finger in Numbers 31 and turn over to Isaiah for a moment. Find Isaiah 10. Because there is a very direct parallel to what God said about the Amorites, and then God used Israel to judge the Amorites, and yet God continues having to train and judge and punish the Israelites, who he used to punish the Amorites. Chapter 10 of Isaiah says, This is talking about Assyria. Let's start in like verse 5. Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger and the staff in whose hands is my indignation. I send Syria against a godless nation, and I commission it against the people of my fury to capture booty, to seize plunder, and to trample them down like mud in the streets. Do you know who he's sending Assyria to attack?
Israel.
The same people he used to take care of the Amorite problem. Later, when they fail to follow him correctly, he brings Assyria down on Israel. But then keep reading. Yet it does not so intend, nor does it plan so in its heart, but rather it is its purpose to destroy and to cut off many nations. So he says, now Assyria's plan is just to cut off nations and destroy people. That's Assyria's master plan. Conquer, make a bigger empire for us. But God says they are actually serving my purpose because they are punishing my people Israel, who deserve to be punished at this moment. So I'm going to use Syria and their desire to conquer nations in order to humble my people Israel. But then verse 8 says, for Syria says, are not my princes all kings? Is not Calno like Carchemish, or Hamath like Arpad, or Samaria like Damascus? In other words, he's comparing the areas of Canaan to kingdoms he had already conquered. He says, what's the difference between the ones I'm about to conquer and the ones I've already conquered? All my princes are like kings. We're such a great empire. As my hand has reached to the kingdoms of the idols, whose graven images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria, shall I not do to Jerusalem and her images just as I have done to Samaria and her idols? So it will be that when the Lord has completed all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, he will say, I will punish the fruits of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the pomp of his haughtiness. Now think about that. Because what God just said was, I'm going to use Assyria to punish Israel. But when I have accomplished all the work in Jerusalem I intend to do, the work is punishing Israel. The work is using Assyria to punish Israel. And when I have finished that work, then I am going to turn on Assyria and I'm going to punish Assyria for the haughtiness with which they conquered my people. So I'm going to use them to punish my people, and I'm going to allow them to conquer my people because that is their heart and their desire. I'm going to use their wicked heart and their evil desire to punish my people. After I have used them, I'm going to judge them for how they punished my people. Can you deal with that? It's the God of the Bible. This is the same God who said, now, the iniquity of the Amorites is not quite full. So I'm going to give them 400 years. And then I'm going to bring my people back to this land, and they're going to conquer the Amorites. And they're going to wipe them out because now their fullness has grown. Now, by the way, here's a good question. Where the Amorites are concerned, were they in fact just innocent and then attacked by Israel? No, from God's perspective, they were not only guilty, but he let their guilt grow until they were so guilty that he just wiped them out, justifiably. Just come in and start conquering because these people are just wicked in my sight. But God let their wickedness grow and then punish them for it. Why didn't God, big loving marshmallow God, why didn't God intervene and say, now look, you Amorites, you know, I love you. And I have a wonderful plan for your life.
You can have your best life now.
If you will just listen to Amrach Osteen, he has something to tell you. Just listen, and he will tell you how to have a better life. No, the God of the Bible says you're evil, and I'm not just going to judge you for evil now. I'm going to let your evil grow until it has come to a fullness of evil, and then I'm going to punish you for that evil. And I'm going to use my people Israel to punish you, and then I'm going to use Assyria to punish Israel, and then I'm going to punish Assyria for the way they punished Israel, even though I sovereignly used them to do it.
That is fascinating. I'm sorry that he just said that. It's so, like, overwhelming. It's like, wow.
It is overwhelming, isn't it?
It's so
sovereign.
Yeah.
It's so sovereign.
That's the word I wanted to use, but I was like,
it's very, very hard for us to wrap our brains around a God who is that intimately involved in the righteousness and wickedness of the people of the planet, that he uses whole people groups to accomplish his will, and that he uses sinful people to punish his righteous called elect. But then he punishes the sinful people for punishing his chosen elect. So I said all that to say, in terms of introduction, that's all introduction to what we're understanding about what's happening in Numbers 31. Sure, yeah, it did seem unfair from a human standpoint, from a fleshly standpoint. It did seem unfair that God would just tell Israel, now go in there and wipe out those people and take all their stuff. But God said to Abraham way back there, now this is what's going to happen. I'm going to bring you back here and I'm going to give you this land. But not yet, because the people who were there, I want to let their iniquity build up to its fullness. And so Israel spent 400 years in Egyptian bondage so that God could let the Amorites' iniquity brew to the full. That's really, really sovereign. Do you think, let's say you're an Israelite living in Egypt 200 years into their bondage. Your whole life, you live and die an Egyptian slave. That's your whole life. Do you have any knowledge of the grand, great scheme of God that's at work? Probably not. You're born in Egypt, you're born into a slave family, you're a slave your whole life, and you die a slave. And that was your life. Is that fair? Sure. Because God had a plan he was working out, and he was using 400 years of Israelites in Egypt to accomplish his plan, which was to let the Amorites' iniquity grow and then punish them with a great army from Israel. God knew what he was doing, but there were a whole lot of bit players in that who, even though they were a vital part of God's grand scheme, probably never knew it because they were just doing their life. So you really genuinely have no idea what God's doing in your life.
Some of those who brought out of Egypt thought it was wonderful. They wanted to go back.
Exactly. Remember those leeks and onions and garlic? Remember the great food in Egypt?
Yes.
Wish we could go back. Sure. And the first generation he brought out, he killed in the wilderness. Yes, sir.
What does it mean when it says in verse 9, where it says it's not carnal like carcinogenic?
He's talking about areas, because he's going out to conquer. The king of Assyria is going out to conquer. And so the first in those three comparisons, the first city is a city in Canaan, which he's going to go conquer. The second one is a city he has already conquered somewhere in the Middle East. So what he's saying is, there's no way I can not conquer them. It'd be like if I had already conquered Nashville, and then I'm coming towards Smyrna,
yeah, okay.
I'm going to go, is Smyrna any better than Nashville? You know, if I took Nashville, I'm taking Smyrna. That's what he's saying. Aren't those cities I'm about to conquer the same as the ones I've already conquered? I'm just going to take them. So that's the point of that. Yep. All right, now we're in Numbers. The army has all come back. Eleazar the priest, starting in verse 21, said to all the men who had gone into the battle that there was a statute of the law which the Lord commanded to Moses. Only the gold and the silver and the bronze and the iron and the tin and the lead and everything that can stand the fire will pass through the fire and be clean. Everything else will be purified with water. They'll wash all their clothes on the seventh day, and then they will be clean, and then they can enter the camp, even though God sent them into this battle because they had been around dead people. They still had to be ceremonially clean before they could come back into the camp. Starting at verse 25 of Numbers 31. All right, everybody there? Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, you and Eleazar the priest and the heads of the fathers' households of the congregations, take account of, okay, what's your translation say after that?
The booty.
Okay, good, that's what I wanted to hear, all right. You take account of the booty that was captured, both of man and of animal, and divide the booty between the warriors who went out to battle and among all the congregation. So they're going to take all the stuff, and he's going to list the stuff in a minute. It's an impressive amount of stuff they've come back with. And he says, now take all the stuff and divide it in half. Half of it you're going to give to the men who went to the war. The other half goes to everybody in Israel. Here's the way it divides out. Divide the booty, verse 27, between the warriors who went out to battle and all the congregation. And levy a tax for the Lord from the men of war who went out to battle. 1 in 500 of the persons and of the cattle and of the donkeys and of the sheep, take it from their half and give it to Eleazar the priest as an offering to the Lord. Now think about this. 1 in every 500 people, cattle, donkeys, and sheep went to the high priest. Wouldn't that make the high priest kind of rich? Yeah, but God said that's the way you do it. You give all that to the high priest as an offering to the Lord. Then he says, and from the sons of Israel's half, you shall take one drawn out of every 50 instead of 500. It's just going to be a lot more this time. A lot more taken out of the half that goes to the congregation. Out of every 50, you take the persons, the cattle, the donkeys, the sheep, and all the animals, and you give them to the Levites, who keep charge of the tabernacle of the Lord. So God made sure, before the distribution happened, to either the soldiers or to the people, he made sure that his ministry was taken care of first. That his Levites, that his priests, they got the first share. So now the numbers run like this, and Moses and Eleazar the priest did just as the Lord had commanded. Now the booty that remained from the spoil which the men of war had plundered was 675,000 sheep. Who counted that? But they had to go through and count them, and every 500th one, that one belongs to God. If it was out of the peoples, every 50th one, that goes to the Levites. So they go through and do a count. And 72,000 cattle and 61,000 donkeys. Of the human beings, of the women who had not known a man intimately, all their persons were 32,000. And the half, the portion of those that went out to war was as follows. The number of sheep then was 337,500. That would be, of course, half of 675,000. And the Lord's levy of the sheep was 675. Which went right to the high priest. And the cattle were 36,000, and the Lord's levy was 72. And the donkeys were 30,500, from which the Lord's levy was 61. And the human beings were 16,000, from which the Lord's levy was 32 persons. And Moses gave the levy, which was the Lord's offering, to Eleazar the priest, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. As for the sons of Israel's half, which Moses separated from the men who had gone to war, now the congregation's half was 337,500 sheep and 36,000 donkeys and 30,500 donkeys, and of the human beings, 16,000. And from the sons of Israel's half, Moses took one drawn from every 50, both of man and of animal, and gave them to the Levites, who kept charge of the tabernacle of the Lord, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. It means if you went to the war, you actually came home with more than the people who stayed home. If you were one of the people who stayed home, which is the greater majority of the congregation, you got a much smaller payment. Even though you got something, you got a smaller payment than those that actually went to war. The people who went and put their lives on the line to defend God's honor and conquer the land and take care of the people, they got a bigger reward. God is fair, and it's interesting that he took the time to say exactly how that was going to be divided up. That also means that God is intimately involved with your stuff, because he knew exactly how much stuff there was. And he said how the stuff would be divided up and how much stuff everybody would get. So let me add one more quick caveat here. What I read from this, then you see if you get the same thing out of it, is that God took his portion up front and then gave everybody in Israel a gift of stuff, of sheep, of cattle, even of persons. And he gave it to them, which means There's nothing wrong with what God has given you. Whatever he's given you, that's yours. Enjoy it. I know people who have enough stuff that it makes them feel guilty. They think, oh, I have so much stuff. And my answer to them is always, and what do you do with it? Do you heap it all on your flesh? Or do you do good things with it? But once you have provided the Lord's portion, what's left is yours. And it's perfectly okay for you to count it as yours and use it the way you choose to use it and enjoy it. It's God's gift to you. God would have had every right to say, now everything the soldiers brought back, because I kept them alive, it all belongs to me. But he didn't. He took one of 50 or one of 500, and then he took the rest and said, now divide it among the people. It's a gift from God to the people. So you don't get to say, well, then it's all mine, and God gets nothing. God right up front said, me first, I get my portion. And then he used his portion to take care of his ministries, the priests and the Levites that he put in place. And then after that, he said, now the rest of it, give it to the people. It belongs to the people. So I think we can at least draw from this passage that whatever God has given you, enjoy it and say thank you. Right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, this is very interesting because starting at verse 48, then the officers who were over the thousands of the army, the captains of thousands and the captains of hundreds, approached Moses and they said to Moses, your servants have taken a census of men of war who are in our charge, and no man of us is missing. The captains of hundreds and the captains of thousands went back and took a count to find out how many heads they lost, which, by the way, was standard operating procedure after a war. The captains had to account for the people they led into battle. And can you imagine the scene? Here they're reporting it to Moses, but imagine the captains of hundreds reporting to the captains of thousands, and the captains of thousands going back and reporting to the leaders, and they have to, with each step of the process, come in and say, I got everybody. And the next captain of 100 come in and says, I got everybody. And the next captain of 100 comes in and says, I didn't lose anybody. You know, at some point they had to start saying, there's a trend happening here. And they must have been waiting for that first guy to walk up and say, well, yeah, you know, I lost someone. But to the man, every captain of hundreds had reported to the captains of thousands, who reported to the leaders, and they come to Moses and they say, we haven't lost anybody. The natural human response to that would be that they would put out their chest and say, man, are we good fighters. You know, that whole 40 years wandering in the wilderness made us into a rough and tumble army. But listen to what they did. Verse 50, so we have brought as an offering to the Lord. They recognized that it was the Lord who did this. We have brought as an offering to the Lord what each man found, articles of gold, armlets, bracelets, signet rings, earrings and necklaces, to make atonement for ourselves before the Lord. In other words, you know, when they're out there fighting, plundering and pillaging, you just pick stuff up, throw it in your bag. Bracelet here, earring there, gold, whatever you find, you just throw it in your bag. And whatever the plundering armies came back with, they usually got to keep. The big stuff, the men, the cattle, the people, the big stuff is what they brought back that was designated to be divided up. But each soldier along the way would just grab stuff. Here they brought all the stuff they grabbed and said, give this to God in exchange for our lives, to make atonement for us, because it's God that kept us alive. What a wonderful realization they came to. And then what did they do? They immediately said, we need to make an offering to the Lord. We need to recognize that he's the one that kept us alive. One of the things I try to do with my kids is, even though my kids are quite grown now, ever since they were little, we finished the day praying together. And we pray over our meals, and I've just tried to raise up my kids to be praying people. But what I have tried to instill in them, and it's interesting when I hear them pray, is that from the time they were very little, I taught them to thank God for stuff, you know, what they have. And I have taught them to say, thank you for my life. Today, I had food. Today, I had clothes on my back. Today, I had a roof over my head. Thank you for my warm bed. and the bricks that are around me. It's cold outside and I'm warm. I mean, we try to remember all the time that whatever our circumstances, whatever we have, it's God that did it. And human beings have a very natural tendency to think that they have what they have because they worked hard and they achieved and they got up every day and self-made man and just went out and did it and that's why they have what they have. But if God didn't give you the health to get through the day, you couldn't have gone out and done the work to get the stuff. If God hadn't provided you the breath, you wouldn't have been able to get up and go do those things. If God hadn't given you the mind to know your work, you couldn't have performed your tasks and your job. No matter what it is you have, no matter what's going on in your life, it's God. It's God's gift. I encourage people to be generous all the time. I'm not going to turn this into a giving sermon, but they did just give a huge gift. But I encourage generosity out of Christians all the time. And I don't try to use tricks or devices. I don't tell people, if you don't give, we're going off in your city. You know, we're going to have to go off the internet if you don't give this week. We don't do anything to put pressure on people and make them give. But what I do tell people is, if GCA is an encouragement to you, if GCA is valuable to you, if you want the teaching that we do to remain available for you, then you ought to support it. But from this passage, I would go beyond that and say, did you have anything to eat today? Did you have clothes on your back today? Did you have a house today? Did you have enough gas to get to work? Do you know your name? Are you breathing easily? Were you sick and then you got well? Say thanks. Say thanks to God. And Paul picks it up in the New Testament and says that when you give to the ministry, to the work of the gospel, that that is a sacrificial gift that sends a pleasing aroma into the nostrils of God. If you want to please God, you go back and say thanks, and that is often done materially. The soldiers here picked up stuff they thought was going to make them richer, wealthier, picking up gold and bracelets and rings and things that they could, you know, take back to their wives and girlfriends and things that they could take home and say, this will make me rich someday. And they brought it to God in exchange for their lives to make atonement before God for the fact that they lived. And so I would encourage folks to take a good hard look every single day at how phenomenally fortunate you are. Everybody in the sound of my voice right now. If you're hearing me right now, it's because you have a computer and you're connected to the internet. You have access to the great libraries of the world and some of the greatest preaching the world has ever heard. I'm not talking about me there. I'm talking about the fact that you do have access to a phenomenally large library of gospel preaching and teaching on the internet, more than any generation before you. You have access to things that generations before you would have died to get a hold of. And if you're on the internet, then you probably had something to eat today, because you've got some change in your pocket. If you're okay today, God did that. If you're warm right now on a cold night, God did that. If you know your name, God did that. If you had a job and you had a couple dollars in your pocket, God did that. If he kept you alive through another difficult circumstance, God did that. There's really nothing you can point to in the universe of a sovereign God. There's nothing you can point to that God didn't do. And yet, how often do we really go back and say thank you? How often do we really go back and say, I'm going to take something precious and I'm going to give it away just to say thank you, to atone for how wonderful it is that you've given me all this? It's funny how people think that they can give too much for the church. Oh, now I'm meddling, but there you go. It's funny how people think, oh, don't give too much to a church. Don't give too much to a preacher. Don't want to get big-headed. A real man of God, you can't give too much money to, because he'll do what's right with it. He won't go buy a private jet. There, I just separated those people. And anyway, but you can't, Tom's going, here come the emails. But you can't overpay somebody whose heart is committed to God. You can't give him too many gifts because he's going to do what's good with them. But if God gives you and gives you and gives you and you hoard it to yourself and you enrich yourself with it and you close off the kindness of giving to people who have needs, then at some point God is going to recognize your stinginess and he has a long, rich history of taking away everything from people like that. If you have something today, it's because God's letting you have it. It's God who's providing it. And yet you start thinking, mine, mine, I can't give that to anybody else, or I can't give that to the church, I can't give that to the work of the ministry, that's mine. All this stuff, the booty that was divided up among Israel, did they do anything for it? The congregation, I mean?
No.
No, but did God give it to them anyway?
Yeah.
Yes. The soldiers, they went into the fight, but they all came back alive. So who did it? God. And he divided it up among them in such a way that they were going to come away with plenty of stuff. God provided all that stuff, and I like their reaction to come back with all the gold and all the stuff and say, we just want to say thank you. I think Christian people ought to stop and say thank you far more frequently than they do. Oh, good, you're all nodding. Okay, good. Starting at verse 51, Moses and Eleazar, the chief priests, took the gold from them, all kinds of wrought or made articles, and all the gold of the offering which they offered up to the Lord from the captains of thousands and from the captains of hundreds was 16,750 shekels. Do your ESV notes tell you how much that is?
420 pounds.
420 pounds of gold.
Wow.
Now, by the way, this is 420 pounds of gold for a little tent with a holy of holies in it where a priest goes. What is Eleazar the priest going to do with 420 pounds of gold?
Weave it into fabric.
He's going to do all kinds of things with it. But by the way, God was enriching the ministry of his service, and there was nothing wrong with it. So wrapping up this chapter, what I see is God gave the people stuff, and there was nothing wrong with that, and the people had every right to enjoy the stuff they were given. God made sure to put himself first and said, okay, there's my portion, and then there's your portion. And then there's nothing wrong with you enjoying your portion. But among those who recognized that God delivered them and kept their lives, they brought yet even a bigger portion, an offering that they brought to make atonement, and there was nothing wrong with that either. And so giving generously, good, you ought to. Receiving and receiving thankfully, good, you ought to. If God gives to you, take it and say thanks. If God gives you life, take it and say thanks. If God provides for you, enjoy what he's provided, but don't forget him, and don't forget to say thanks. Right?
Right.
Okay. I looked at Tom because I knew he'd agree with me. Yeah, oh, there, Charlie's got the big nod going. Yeah, that's better. The men of war had taken booty, every man for himself. So Moses and Eleazar the priest took the gold from the captains of the thousands and of the hundreds and brought it into the tent of meeting as a memorial for the sons of Israel before the Lord. They took the 430 pounds of gold and they put it in the tent. Which means every time they move the tent, they got to move 430 pounds of gold. 420 pounds of gold. They got to move all that gold every time they move. But it belongs to God now. It's God's gold. Is it okay for God to have all that gold? There are people today who would say, no, 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 it's not. What if we just had 420 pounds of gold laying around? There'd be somebody in the Smyrna paper writing, that little church has 420 pounds of gold sitting in one of their rooms. That's not right. What are they doing with that? Why do they have that much gold sitting around? They should do something with it. Well, God is building up on purpose a treasure because someday he's going to want a temple and a whole lot of gold furnishings, and he's providing it for himself because God puts himself at the top of the list. God, yeah. All right, we will start in chapter 32 this week. We're a couple minutes early, but hey, you get to quit early tonight. I'm giving you 7 minutes that I'll take back someday. But there's no point in starting into the next chapter. That goes into my debit account. I get to pull that later. But there's no point in starting in the next chapter because that's going to be about the division of the land. And very much like we saw here, God dividing up the stuff, God's going to be consulted and determine where each of the tribes are going to be planted in the land. And once he gives them that land, it is theirs in perpetuity. It's theirs forever. That's their lot of land. And he has set all these laws in place where if you lose your land through debt, through borrowing, every Jubilee year, it goes back to what God said it was. So even as you take debt against your land, you had to figure how many years till the year of Jubilee, because you were always going to get your stuff back because God said it was yours. So that ties in, and we'll make those applications next week. Okay? All right, good. Any questions? Good. Did you enjoy that? Mm-hmm. You glad you came here?
Yeah. Always enjoy it.
You glad you came from your heated houses, in your heated cars, to your heated church, where you walked on carpet and sat here in your beautiful clothing with your full stomachs and got to listen to God's word taught and expressed while you sat in comfort? Are you happy you got all that?
It's a blessing.
Yeah, say thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, you get the point, don't you? All right.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.